Three.
Welcome to In the Studio with a 21st Century Perspective on History's Greatest Rock Albums. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, it's the 40th anniversary of the album that established Texas-bred guitarist Steve Miller as one of the 70s biggest stars.
Like an Eagle came out, and I thought I really had it, you know. When I finished that album, I knew that's what people wanted to hear. I went and told my record company that I was going to sell 4.5 million copies of it. I mean, I didn't say it in an arrogant way. I just said, this record is going to sell 4.5 million copies. It's going to be the biggest thing I ever did. Time keeps on slipping into the Hey, this is Steve Miller in the studio for the anniversary of Fly Like an Eagle.
In 1973, Steve Miller had a number one hit single with The Joker, but it was his spring 1976 follow-up album Fly Like an Eagle that guaranteed his place in rock history. Rolling Stone magazine named Fly Like an Eagle as its album of the year for the entire year 1976, and now ranks that album at number 442 on the top 500 all-time best list. Raised in Dallas, Texas, befriended as a child prodigy by Les Paul and T-Bone Walker, Steve Miller got an intense musical graduate school after the University of Wisconsin at nearby Chicago's South Side with blues masters Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, Willie Dixon, Buddy Guy and Junior Wells, and Jimmy Reed. Steve Miller and schoolboy chum Boz Scaggs took their blues internship westward to the vibrant San Francisco musical scene in 1967, where the Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane, and Moby Grape were landing major label record deals. Steve Miller landed the most lucrative contract of all and proceeded to record and release 4 critically acclaimed albums by 1973. For that year's The Joker, Steve Miller had taken full creative control for the first time, with the result being his first number one hit. Here's Steve Miller with me in the studio.
I'd been working with Glenn Johns, and it seemed like all the time that I was working on my records, I was always arguing with the engineer or arguing with somebody about how I wanted it to be. When I made The Joker, I just went down and did it by myself. It was the first time I had really walked into a studio and called all the shots and was in complete charge. And, getting a number one record kind of made me feel like, well, see, and so from that time on, I never really looked back. Then I just, as soon as we got back from, I think we had about a 60-city tour on The Joker, and we came back and everybody was completely fried. We were just exhausted. We had been basically touring nonstop for 11 years or something like that. And the band fell apart. We went into the studio and naturally Capitol's going, we want a new one. We want another one immediately. And, went into the studio for a few days and I just called him up and said, you know what? We can't record anything. We've made so many albums so quickly that it's just going to take me some time. And, the band is really, fallen apart. We're burned out. So, I'll be in touch when I'm ready. And then I called up my agent and told him not to book any gigs for a year, which of course blew his mind. You know, once you have a little success, then there's a lot of pressure on you to capitalize on that. And what I did was I shut everything down and went to my house and got a tape recorder, a multi-track, 8-track tape recorder set up in my living room and started first resting, then thinking, then writing. And then a year later, I went into the studio and called up Gary Malibur and Lonnie Turner, and we went in and cut about 20, 25 tracks. in 11 days, and I took them home and started working on them at home. And about 18 months later, I'd finished Fly Like an Eagle and Book of Dreams.
After finally stepping off the album tour merry-go-round, and with some creative and financial breathing room afforded by the hit success of The Joker, Steve Miller proceeded to replenish his musical wellspring. It's remarkable what he found.
We started going through all of this stuff, and we found all these ridiculous outtakes. We have the original demos, the very first demos that I made for Take the Money and Run and Rockin' Me. Fly Like an Eagle from, like 72, 73, I guess, when we were playing it on the stage, and it's called In the Ghetto. and it's got, when you hear all this stuff, it'll blow your mind. Like Take the Money and Run. I think it's Take the Money and Run. It has a really great chorus that I should have used, but I sort of just threw it away and didn't use that. And I went back and I heard that and I said, man, that was even better. Why didn't I use that one? Just all these ideas and stuff that I was doing with a drum machine and a guitar and a little four-track cassette deck or something,
It was a tune that we played live, and I'd been playing the tune live for like 3 years. Every time we played it, people loved it, and it always was kind of a light show thing where the mirror ball would come on and the concert hall would get kind of dark and we would jam, and I had all the Echoplex stuff going on and everything, and it was, really, we were just out there doing these sound collages, and I could never get that feeling of that mirror ball on that tune until I got the synthesizer, and the synthesizer put it together, made it all happen. When I got the synthesizer that I used on the tune Fly Like an Eagle, we had a very complex one, and none of the keyboard players that I worked with would use the keyboard that I chose. None of them would buy it or play it. So I went to the music store and I said, I want the idiot-proof synthesizer. I said, I want one that makes a sound like wind, and one that does a sitar, and one that does this, and one does that. The guy says, we got just what you need right over here, Steve. He sold me this little keyboard. And I took that back to the studio and did all that on Fly Like an Eagle with that keyboard. I always wanted to make these concept albums and use sound effects, and I was fascinated with the quality of sound and, the sound of wind chimes and then somebody playing little finger drums and all of these kind of things. And when I got my first synthesizer, my own, it was a very simple one. And one of the things it had to do was it had to have wind in it. And I based everything, when I say wind, I had to have something that sounded like wind. And I based all of my, when I built my sounds with a synthesizer, I always started with wind, or I would have an ocean sound in it. And that's what makes it sound warm and organic. And it just was a natural way for me to go. I mean, that was the way I heard things and the way I wanted things to be.
Fascinating. In its simplicity, you may never have noticed that the song Wild Mountain Honey never, ever changes key from the Steve Miller Band's Fly Like an Eagle album. Next, Steve Miller helps change the way Americans would forever listen to music on the radio. Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's newest honoree, Steve Miller's entire catalog, including this Fly Like an Eagle album, has now been remastered for iTunes. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Steve Miller for the 40th anniversary of Fly Like an Eagle.
This is Stevie Guitar Miller in the studio with Redbeard, the bearded one, for the anniversary of Fly Like an Eagle.
Thanks, buddy. With the master tapes from a year of writing and recording in his own living room, Steve Miller felt like he was ready for the next step.
I went to L.A. to mix the album, and so I was driving because I had a lot of equipment that I wanted to take and instruments that I wanted to have with me for those last few little things that always happen. And I bought a bunch of albums to listen to on the way down just to check the mixes and stuff. Bought some popular things, some of this, some of that. And I was really surprised at how bad all the albums were, because they would have like one or two great songs and then like eight just throwaway songs, And the record industry had gone back to that same thing. They're there right now, where you have one hit song and then you just fill a bunch of stuff in with the old drum machine or whatever. And I realized that I had enough material for two albums when I went down to mix, and I was going to take the best of these two albums and make one album. Mercury Blues has a special meaning to me. I first heard it on a Folkways roadside recording. Alan Lomax made the recording, and it was one that my dad had, and I just love this song about Mercury Blues. It was by a guy named Casey Douglas, and I started doing it, and we did it in high school with my band, and yeah, we just made it our song, you know, and played it. So I was out in San Francisco. I was playing at the Matrix when I first got to town. I used to explain to people where a lot of my tunes came from, and I talked about this tune, and my karma was just perfect this night because I was sitting there going, talking about Casey Douglas and the roadside recording and all this stuff. And after the set, this guy who looks like a high school principal, he's got a little short crew cut, a black man with a big sweatshirt on, comes up and introduces himself, and he's Casey Douglas, and he lived in Oakland, California.
During that time in which Steve Miller was woodshedding all of these songs, an opportunity arose that would pay off big time in several ways.
I hadn't played for about a year and a half, I guess, and I got a call from Pink Floyd, and Pink said, "Hey, Steve, we want you to come over, and we're going to play at Nebworth, outside of London, this big outdoor venue, and we think there's going to be about 60,000 people there, and we'd really like you to come over." And I said, "God, you know, I don't have my band together right now. I'm really not ready, blah, 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 and I really can't do it." And then they called back and said, "No, we really want you to do it, you know." And I said, "Well, it'll be real expensive. I won't be able to do it." And then they called back and finally said, "It's going to cost, you know, like this huge amount of money." And I just thought that would end it, you know. And they said, "Okay, that's fine," you know. And I sort of went, "Whoa." So I called up, get this, they called up Doug Clifford from Creedence Clearwater. I got Lonnie Turner, and I got a hold of Les Dudek from Boz's band. And got them together, and I wrote Rockin' Me for the big end of the show tune when I went over to play with them. That's what I wrote Rockin' Me for. And I was just imagining Nebworth, and I wrote that song. We went and did that, and then came back, and then I started, that really got me going, you know, and we knocked the audience out, and there were, instead of 60,000 people, there were like 130,000 people. It was an unbelievable show, big success and everything, and we knocked everybody out. So I came back and started working on my next album. I didn't like Rockin' Me, and I almost took it off the record. I mean, it just... barely. It was the last decision I made, and I was tired, and it was kind of like, "Oh, all right, you know, I guess we'll leave it on." And I recut it three times, and it just kept getting worse and worse, and I didn't like, I was struggling with the song. I didn't like the way it was working or anything, and I always thought it was a very lazy-sounding track and that it just didn't have it. It just wasn't what I thought it was supposed to be. As soon as it was out, everybody just thought it was the greatest hit in the world. And I mean, I'd never in my life had people just going, "You're plugging the wrong song. You know, you don't know what you're doing." You know, I had disc jockeys, you know, we were on the road all the time. And we always had parties where we would invite people from the record company in the town we were playing in and their accounts and DJs to come backstage. And I just had people pulling on my sleeve like, "Steve, I've got to talk to you about this. You know, you know, you've got to fix this, you know." Yeah. Just guys who really wanted to tell me, you know. And, I mean, they were pulling for the record, boy. I mean, everybody was on our side in radio, and it was a real good time. It really was.
Steve Miller throwing open the window on Fly Like an Eagle's 40th anniversary. Still to come, Steve Miller goes postal. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, tweet at Redbeard Rocks, and visit online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee Steve Miller for the 40th anniversary of Fly Like an Eagle.
This is Stevie Guitar Miller in the studio with Redbeard, the bearded one, for the anniversary of Fly Like an Eagle.
Thanks again, buddy. Steve Miller has a theory why Fly Like an Eagle is practically synonymous with his whole career.
It's like a tour through my roots, you know. You can see everything I'm doing right now. You know, there's that little jazz thing from Blue Odyssey. There's the blues. There's the pop stuff. There's the acoustic stuff. There's the little instrumental things. There's the space. Those are all the different elements that I bring to my music. And, you know, I like it that way because it gives me a lot more freedom of expression, too. And I'm interested in all these different kinds of music, and they've all moved me, and they've all added to my musical history. Fly Like an Eagle came out, and I thought I really had it. You know, when I finished that album, I knew that's what people wanted to hear. I went and told my record company that I was going to sell 4.5 million copies of it. I mean, I didn't say it in an arrogant way. I just said, this record is going to sell 4.5 million copies. It's going to be the biggest thing I ever did. Here it comes. And as soon as it went out to radio, it was so astonishing because, you know, FM radio had just finally become established and was really beginning to open up and get a big audience and really compete with AM radio. This was 75, 76. Yeah. They were really beginning to get their own, who cares what the top 40 is? This is ours, you know? And they would play that whole album, both sides, without interruption, for weeks. I mean, it was what they wanted to sound like. It was what they wanted. It's what I wanted.
Decades later, no less than the venerable U.S. Postal Service wanted to make their bald eagle logo take off and fly.
Well, that was interesting. We got a phone call from the ad agency saying we'd like to buy the rights to Fly Like an Eagle. And we've got an idea for a commercial. And I said, well, let me see what your ideas are. I said, I normally don't do this with my music, but the post office and Fly Like an Eagle sounds good. What do you got in mind? So they had already made this commercial that was a full tilt commercial. It wasn't a little pre-production tape or anything. And it was very well done. And so we got into serious negotiations and they wanted to use Fly Like an Eagle to rebrand the post office. They used it in their communication systems to cheer up their employees. There was a lot of going postal in those days and they were really in trouble and they needed a way to just change everything and to make, the public aware of the post office. And so that was the plan. And after a long series of negotiations in which I was given complete 100% artistic control over the post office's advertising, I agreed to let them use the song. But there was Redbeard, there was this classic phone call. And I said, there's a reason why I haven't let people do anything with my music, because usually they mess it up. So I said, here's the rules. I said, I will do this. I will negotiate a deal with you, but only with the understanding that I have 100% artistic control over your advertising. I said, 100% total artistic control over what you're making. And I said, I'll give you an answer in 48 hours, and I won't hold you up unreasonably. But I said, that's the ground rules. And if you guys can't abide by that ground rule, number one, then there's no sense in us even talking anymore. And there was this long silence. they eventually agreed to that. So I went to him and I said, listen, and we can re-record this so you can have a modern recording of it and it'll be easier to take it apart and do different mixes and you can do all these things. He said, oh no, absolutely has to be the original. We don't want anything but the original. I said, well, that's fine. That's easy. That's already done. So the first ad came out. It was not delivered to me in time. It was on the air before they gave it to me. It sounded like somebody had edited the music with Scotch tape. When I heard it, I almost tripped. It was so out of rhythm, So I got on their case and said, look, you have to follow the rules. If you don't follow the rules, you don't get the music, So we got off to a rough start. Then the second ad they sent me was recorded by a band in Mexico City that sounded like a jazz group. And I said, what are you people doing? And they said, well, we have to do this for our Spanish-speaking audiences. And I said, we made a deal. I have 100% artistic control. I have lots of fans of Mexico and Spain who know Fly Like an Eagle. And you have to leave the song alone or I am taking it back right now. So I was absolutely right to get control of it or it would have been recorded by Pee Wee Herman's band the next week, And so every ad had to be sent to me. I would review it. I would view it. And then I would either agree or disagree. I have copies of what they tried to do and it's, someday maybe on a comedy record, we'll put it out, but it,
it shows you that if you're going to do something like this, there has to be some artistic integrity retained, or an advertising agency will just, you know, pour ketchup all over it or whatever they want to do. So that's the way it worked. And to their credit, they agreed. And I think the ads ran for 5 years or something like that. It was a long run. Once they really understood the ground rules, then, you know, I didn't really have to change much. The irony of all of this, the real irony of this, and the story can now be told. I finally had to tell them, look, you're the only people that I do business with that can't get me a package by 10:30 the next morning. And I said, the first ad you sent me by, priority mail arrived 8 days late. And that's why I didn't see the first ad. And you couldn't say the word FedEx to these guys, they all wince. And finally I just said, look, I don't care. You got to send it by FedEx because I can't do business with you. You're too late, and they were always late. They're always, they'd finish an ad at, 4:30 in Friday afternoon and want to put it out that night, they finally had to use FedEx. So I guess the post office did have some problems.
See Steve Miller inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Saturday, April 30th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on HBO. Then enjoy Steve Miller's entire catalog remastered for iTunes. And Steve returns here in the studio next week for the best of the rest. I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio congratulating my guest Steve Miller for induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Steve's going to return next week. In the Studio was written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2016, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brune. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter, @RedbeardRocks, and online at inthestudio.net.